Oh no. I just realised that the notes on my phone haven't synced with the notes I just typed up on my computer about this week's guest. So now I've got to walk back home, open up my laptop, get it to sync with my phone, then come back out. I'm just saying, you think this podcasting lark is easy. It's not. It's highly skilled and it's really difficult. I've got to walk back now and it's cold and I didn't bring my gloves. So just think about that for a while. Rosie, come on. I've got to go back and get my phone to sync with my laptop. Come on, Rose. That's what I'm talking about. A flypast from the hairy bullet. All right, I'll see you in a second.
I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke.
My name is Adam Buxton, I'm a man.
I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Right, back on track. Literally, metaphorically. Only half an hour later, it's now nearly dark. Cold afternoon. What is the date? I've sort of lost track. Oh my God, it's nearly December. And how you doing, podcat? Sorry, I didn't even say hello or anything. Adam Buxton here. Nice to be with you. A little bit stressed. Just got back from London a little bit earlier. Before then, I was in Ireland doing the last few dates of my book tour show in Belfast and Dublin. Beautiful country, people, an idyllic train journey from Belfast to Dublin. Sun streaming through the windows, the magical Irish countryside sliding past the window of the train. I had a day off in Dublin. I googled music gigs and saw that Sleaford Mods were playing. Went to see Sleaford Mods at the Dublin Olympia with Goat Girl supporting. Amazing. Loved it. It was a great evening. And then I did a final show at Vicar Street in Dublin on the Monday night. And no disrespect to the other wonderful audiences that I've met over the last few months, but I think that Vicar Street audience is hard to beat for the sheer warmth and enthusiasm. Anyway, look, let me tell you a bit about my guest for podcast number 170, British actor and comedian Kayvan Novak. Novak facts. Kayvan, currently aged 42, was born and brought up in London, the son of Iranian parents. After graduating from drama school, he landed roles in shows like Family Affairs, Holby City, and Spooks. On British TV, in 2005, Kayvan and his writer-director friend Ed Tracy made a pilot for a phone prank TV show in which the calls were accompanied by crudely rendered animations. The show was called Phone Jacker, and it became a hit series on Channel 4 in 2007. Despite not being spelled correctly, phone is spelt P-H-O-N-E, not F-O-N-E. Luckily, no one noticed. And in 2010, the Phone Jacker spin-off show, Face Jacker, arrived on Channel 4. This time, Kayvan's characters came to life on screen with the help of elaborate makeup, prosthetics and costume to enable Kayvan to interact with unsuspecting members of the public on camera. All the while, Kayvan continued to take on acting roles, including TV sitcom Phone Shop, phone spelt correctly this time, the Oscar-winning feature film, Syriana, and in 2010, Kayvan starred alongside Riz Ahmed, playing Waj, a dim-witted jihadist from Sheffield, in Chris Morris's film Four Lions. Kayvan, of course, also featured in Morris's 2019 satire of American Homeland Security, The Day Shall Come. More recently, Kay Van has been starring with friends of the podcast Matt Berry and Tash Dimitriou in What We Do in the Shadows. But when we spoke face-to-face in a London hotel room back in late June of this year, 2021, we focused mainly on how Kay Van made the transition from being a jobbing actor, dealing with his share of typecasting, to creating characters from a wide range of nationalities and ethnicities for comic effect on phone and later Facejacker. And we spoke about the joyful and the potentially problematic areas of doing so. Towards the end of the podcast, there's also a clash of the BBC documentarians as Kay Van unleashes the full force of his uncanny Louis Theroux impression, and I respond with my best attempt at Adam Curtis. Back at the end for a bit more waffle, but right now, with Kay Van Novak, here we go.
I'd be really close to this.
Yeah, I like being
Roland Rat's arse
close on the mic. I've got
in
a,
my face.
I've got a big fluffy cover on Kay Van's mic.
Yeah, it's funny. You can watch it on the YouTube stream. Is there a YouTube?
No, I'm not visual. It's not, podcast is not about visuals.
Joe Rogan, mate. You know what I mean? I think I've never listened to his podcast. I've only ever watched it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you watch it right the way through for 3 hours or whatever?
No, I kind of got into watching just clips on YouTube, and then I got into watching him trying to absorb other people's knowledge whilst not being funny ever or making any jokes. And I find that quite, it's fascinating that he can spend that long without cracking a joke, even though he is a comedian and he's a stand-up. I just find that amazing. I mean, I've gone 58 seconds without cracking a joke, which is a long time for me.
Are you always on?
Well, no, I'm always off. Being off, being on, being funny, being extroverted, being introverted. It's something that I can never quite get on top of or decide whether I am introverted or extroverted. Because when I was younger, the people I looked up to, the people I wanted to be like, were charismatic, loud, confident.
Who are we talking about?
Oh, mainly classmates, I'd say. Oh,
okay.
To the point of me being 13, I was the class clown. And I loved my school. I loved the teachers. I just felt like, yes, I knew my place. When I left there, I went to secondary school, and it became like I'd left this little pond, and suddenly all these tributaries of all these Larry kids kind of were all kind of coming into this new lake or ocean, it felt like. I felt very out of place. I didn't know what the fuck I was
doing. No longer the big fish.
No. No longer the big fish. And it was like, no, you're in secondary school. And it was about smoking weed. I didn't till I was 17 or something. Getting girls, which I hadn't. I'd had like one kiss when I was 13. Mm. And then that was it. It was like, ugh.
Were you always a big, good-looking galoot? Or were you sort of one of these people who starts out being quite weird looking in their adolescence and then blossoms into a wonderful looking human?
Like you, Adam. No, I'd say I was handsome. I was tall till I was 13. And then something extraordinary happened. My nose exploded and it became more pronounced, right?
Yeah.
So then I guess I was the class clown up to that point, but it was really, I think my sense of humor was always there, but the personality that I built around it was actually kind of trying to reach around this nose that was in the middle of my face.
Giving your nose a reach around.
Giving my nose a reach around, right? Which it was possible. You know, it was a well-endowed nose, which I've had, you know, since then. I'm sure I've mentioned this. I may not have, but I did have some rhinoplasty.
Did you?
I did, yeah. best thing I ever did.
I've never thought about your nose. You're a very nicely proportioned person.
Well, think about it.
Sure. Was it a curvature that you were unhappy with?
Well, if you see my kind of earlier television work or film work, then my Mark One, as my mate calls it, is there, you know, in all its glory.
Yeah.
You know, in such things as Spooks or Syriana.
Right.
Or George Clooney. You know, my old nose is there. It was weird because it actually coincided with, I guess, from 2001, 2005, playing terrorist, doctor, pimp, strip club manager, which I had great fun doing.
Because you have a strong look. I mean, where are your family from?
Iranian.
Okay.
So they're Iranian, yeah.
So yes, you have that kind of quintessentially Middle Eastern
look.
Look.
And then, yeah, most of the parts I play, I would adopt this kind of Middle Eastern menacing voice.
Is that what your parents sound like?
No. My parents left Iran. They got married at 19, went to America, and moved to Texas, of all places. Went to university in Arlington, Texas. And around the time that I was conceived, the Iranian Revolution was kicking off. You know, it was kind of bubbling under the surface. It was 1978 when I was born. So they decided not to have me in America. They decided to come to the UK. I was born here. Then I went to Iran for a bit, for like 7 months. Then the Iranian Revolution kind of was really kicking off, and they were like, well, we should come back to the UK. So that was the story of my birth.
Mm.
The story of my birth. And then fast forwarding 20 years or whatever, drama school, acting agent, terrorist parts, 2005, oh, nose exploding, 2005, oh God, is it my acting or is it my nose? I haven't been laid in 4 months. This is just, oh my God, get it off. So then found a plastic surgeon called Dr. Matty.
Why did you start getting paranoid about your nose?
I mean,
you get comments or anything?
Yeah, I'd had comments in my life, totally.
Really?
Yeah, man.
But from dicks, though, surely.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. You know, it was prominent. It was part of my identity.
Yeah.
And I would kind of flip-flop between going, I love my nose. Fuck them. You know, this nose is here to stay. And then I wouldn't get an acting job for 8 months. I'd be like, this nose has got to go.
You blame the nose.
I blame the nose. I mean, yeah, I blame the nose. And then I wouldn't blame the nose, and I would blame the nose.
Mm. Were you nervous about getting surgery?
I wasn't, actually. I was really excited about it. Did I even tell my agent? I don't know that. My old agent. My first agent, Simon Beresford. Simon, if you're listening, love you very much. Thank you for all those lunches that we'd go on. Now, listen. I know you haven't worked in 8 months, but look, we're going to get you a little film.
This is Simon.
And get you a lovely part in the film. Maybe a little TV series here and there. You know, might do a couple of shorts. And maybe a theatre run in the West. How does that sound? That sounds great, Simon. Okay, darling, don't call me again. Bye. I mean, you need that. You know, if you're not working, then you're like, my God.
No, I can imagine. That's why, I mean, I've never been an actor in that way.
Have you not?
No.
You've acted in stuff.
Yeah, but only because I knew people who were doing things and they said, oh, do you want to be in this thing?
Lucky. I didn't know anyone. I still don't. It's weird. I know you.
But I only got a couple of parts that way. And then
Hot Fuzz.
Hot Fuzz I got because I knew Edgar a little bit. I still had to audition for it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Cheeky fucker.
I was going to be one of the cops. But I think Kevin Eldon ended up getting the part that I might have played.
Yeah, he's great. He's better. They chose well.
He's always good.
But you were great, man.
Well, all I had to do was get killed. And
you did it so well.
Get slapped on the back very hard by Pierce Brosnan. No, not Pierce Brosnan.
Mrs. Doubtfire.
Not me.
I'm allergic to pepper. Your accent's a little muddled.
That's the noise. Bronson noise. Now, who am I thinking of? Another Bond. Dalton.
Oh, yeah.
Timothy Dalton.
He's great.
I've told this boring story enough. Can't even remember the names.
Yeah. The boring story about Hot Fuzz.
About being in Hot Fuzz and getting slapped too hard on the back.
Well,
Timothy Dalton.
Then I won't mention Hot Fuzz again.
No, that's fine. I like it.
You know what? I threw myself with the whole anecdote about nose jobs.
Oh, yeah. Talk about that?
I've never spoken about that.
Really?
No, I mean, you know.
Why? Because you think it makes you look superficial?
Do you think it's a superficial thing to do?
No, people have surgery all the time. I never quite understand. I understand totally for an actor, for a person who is all about the way they look on camera.
Mm.
You know, that's part of your job. But for an ordinary citizen, I don't know. I suppose it's because I'm quite vain myself, so I just don't want to respond to my vanity in that way. I'm not suggesting that everyone who gets surgery is acting under the same impulses as me, but that's what it feels like to me. I just sort of think, don't worry about it. You're fine. You know, you're you. You don't need to change that thing.
If I'd heard that, which I'm sure I did, I'd just been like, no, I'm still doing it.
Yeah, fair
enough. Worry about, you know, my kids.
Why?
Because, you know, there's a time bomb.
You don't have children yet, right?
Not yet.
No.
But when I do, you know, daddy, there's this thing on my face. So, oh, shit, I didn't tell you. There it is. It's back. It's come back. It's the ghost of Christmas past, and it's on your face.
I can't remember what you... I'm going to have to Google your nose now.
Do it.
What would I look for? Caveman, Novak.
Spooks.
Spooks.
You can watch it on iPlayer.
I mean, you look good.
Yeah.
You look like a guy with a face.
That's what they say.
You really do, though. I just would not look at that person and go, look at the nose guy.
It's a 2D picture. It looked good. I mean, you know, I looked slick. I looked, you know, well-groomed.
Yeah.
But it was just, you know, you need a bit of extra help. And Dr. Matt is going to do that for you. That's, you know, what Dr. Matthew would do. He got me in, sit down, sure, what you don't you like about your nose? I was like, well, you know, this bit is a bit, there's a bit of a hook there, and it's a bit bulbous on the end. Okay, you know what, you will always have big nose, but perhaps we can make it better big nose. I'm like, better big nose it is, man, let's do it. So that's, and it was good, it was great. And then when the anaesthetist kind of put me to sleep, suddenly Dr. Matty's there and I'm like getting sleepy. I'm on the trolley. He's like, tell me again what you want. I'm like, this is...
He was winding you up though, wasn't he?
Was he? I don't know. That's a good wind up.
That's a terrifying wind up.
Yeah.
Just as you're falling under
the
anesthetic.
You want big scoop, yeah? You want big scoop nose? You want the Pamela Anderson scoop nose? Yeah, that's it.
So at what point then did you suddenly take your destiny into your own hands and think, look, acting is fine. I've got other things I can do. I've got my own skills, my own naughty comedic wind-up skills that I can harness to be my own boss.
The lesson I enjoyed most at drama school was radio because I got to be everyone. I got to do all the voices, take piss out teachers, you know. Suddenly, I was like, oh, wow, I can do that thing that I would do all my life, which was watch Spitting Image at the age of 4. And, you know, suddenly I'm Prince Charles. Or, oh, Bottoms. Oh, Prince Philip, what's a Bottoms? You know, just doing that, but like from a young age and then getting wheeled out at dinner parties and doing these impressions. I'm like, okay, well, I'm a natural mimic. But then suddenly I'm like, this career that I have, this acting career, does not utilize any of those skills at all. I'm just going, well, you look like this, so you have to play this kind of character. You look like that, so you have to play that kind of character. It's like, okay, I can do my sinister Middle Eastern accent for you.
Yeah.
But that's it. I'm like, nah, man, this grapefruit ain't getting squeezed. Okay, so I'm like, right, well, I'll go and do a voice tape, and then I'll send it off to all these voiceover agents, and they'll be like, he's incredible. We must have him on our books. Nothing, you know, nothing. I'd call up, hello, did you get my CD? Yeah, sorry, books are full. So I was like, oh, okay. So then that frustration created this beast, this animal that would then go and do these calls where I'd just pretend to be other people, record them, and then send that in. But it was this kind of ball of energy that I knew I had to make a change in my own life somehow, because otherwise I'd just be swallowed up into this, you know, this fucking machine of, I don't even know how to describe it. It was just like, I had to do something. So, you know, a lot of my motivation was kind of political. You know, I do these little, you know, in the same way that you would do your stuff with Joe and, you know, make things. You don't necessarily know why you're making them. You kind of go, well, I have to make it. I have to make this.
My motivation was always to play it to friends.
Yeah. Which I would do eventually after I made these prank calls. I would make a CD and then I would play it. But really, you know, I wanted more than that. I wanted the world to know that I was talented and I could do all these funny voices and I was funny, you know. Mm. I had to escape this, whatever, this glass ceiling of like, no, you will only play these kind of characters and there's no...
You want to be in the driving seat.
I want to be in the driving seat, right?
Hey, you'll need to move much faster in the street. Come on, I want you to be speedy with your feet. You're wasting my valuable time. I got people to meet, but instead I'm moving very slowly behind your ass. Hey!
You're married, right?
I am married, yes.
Happily?
Am I happily married?
Yeah.
Oh, no, not really, no.
No?
No, I always pretend that I am.
Okay.
But I think this is a great opportunity for me to say, not really.
But wait, are you going to get divorced?
I suppose at some point, yeah. No, I'm... Sorry, I haven't thought this riff through.
You're a very good actor. I was very convincing.
Why would I admit that I wasn't happily
it's
married?
It's easier to say that because, you know, I guess part of you is like, am I happy? I don't know. So how are things? Yeah, really great. You know, am I lying?
You're not married yet though, right? Yeah, you have a fiancé.
Yeah. Do you think your listeners are married or are they more single?
I've got no idea.
What are you? Are you married?
Imagine there's quite a few married people listening to this. And they will, I hope, be able to relate to a lot of the things that I say about marriage. It is a very unique condition. It's a constant challenge to keep recalibrating and adapting.
Because of kids?
Everything about it. Everything about just sharing a life and a house with the same person. I mean, this is our 20-year anniversary coming up.
What's your wife called?
I never say.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
she's... I always just call her my wife.
Okay.
Oh, although I don't always do the voice now. She's called Sarah. And
I was spending time with Adam and Sarah. They'd been married for over 40 years. I'd known Adam as a child. We were friends. We used to listen to hip-hop together. I sensed that he was a little tense. I asked him why. Are you a little tense, Adam?
Do the are you okay one.
Are you okay? Well, I don't know. I just got this sense that you hadn't had sex with your wife for about 3 or 4 years.
Are you okay?
Is that presumptive of me to say that?
So you're doing Nick Broomfield, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly what Matt Berry said to me when I did an impression of
That's Louis Theroux, listeners. I'm going to make you do more Louis Theroux later on. But anyway, to circle back round and to close the loop.
The marriage, unhappy marriage.
I believe that I am happily married. I love my wife very much. She's the best thing that ever happened to me. She's an incredible woman. I am very attracted to her.
You give off happy vibes. And I just say, like, when I meet you and speak to you, like, there's a good vibe there.
All right, good. That's a nice thing to say. Yeah. But it is, I mean, it is hard. It's like, you have to kind of, every now and again, you sort of think, oh, they're not doing what I want them to do. And I think it's important that they do this thing that I want them to do. And you have to kind of think really hard, like, is this actually important? Is this worth getting bent out of shape about? And that I'm slowly getting better at judging those moments.
It kind of reminds me of when I hang out with my parents, because they've been married for 50 years and they're still in love and they still make each other laugh. And there's still moments of intense cruelty between them, but they just kind of shake it off. And, you know, my mum will be mean to my dad and my dad will react badly. And yeah,
that's cool. They're still together. That bodes well, man.
Oh man, they're my heroes when it comes to, you know, a lot of things. And that is one of them. They really are cool motherfuckers, a pair of them. You know, they've been a unit. They married at 19 and they're off, man.
At 19?
19.
Good effort.
Very good.
I mean, my parents didn't do so well. I mean,
did they not?
No, as far as each other were concerned.
Did you witness a lot of arguments and shouting growing up?
Yes.
Okay, we don't have to do this. This isn't the cave of Dr. Kevin Novak.
For a while not. And then, but it all just suddenly blew up because my dad got very badly into debt. And
wow.
So there was a period in the 80s where he just didn't know what he was going to do. And he was really out of his depth.
Debt
and,
from gambling?
No, from sending us to posh schools.
Oh, my God.
And
bless him. Bless him for that.
Yeah, well, exactly.
What a waste of fucking money.
Well, I have the thought has occurred to me.
Is that where we met? Did we meet there? Did we meet at
Are
posh
you
school?
Okay?
Are you okay?
Yeah, we did meet at posh school, yeah. That's why we all speak a little bit similarly, like me that. And Joe and Louis. Anyway, look, back to you.
Oh, yeah, back to me.
So all your phone call shenanigans eventually come to the attention. How did they come to the attention of Channel 4? You sent them in or?
No, no. I met a dude at a house party. I said, you look like Matt Letizia. And it was Ed Tracy. I said, what do you do? He said, oh, I'm a director. I said, well, I'm an actor. And he said, oh, well, I'm making a film about a short film about minicab drivers. I was like, I'll be in that. That sounds great, man. I'd love to play a minicab driver. So I went and starred. I did a day's filming on this minicab film where I had a little part. And I just fucking, I was so, it was a summer. I was frustrated. I hadn't had sex in months and months.
Sure.
I wasn't working. I was like, outlet, perform. Performance, go.
Ready to explode.
Explode, you know, in this cab office that he got. He'd hired it out. I was working with other kind of non-actors, and I was just like, I was in heaven, man, and I was on fire that day. And he was filming it, and he was just capturing it. Anyway, I didn't know whether I'd done any good or what. Off I went. Then he was like, I get a call from him. He's like, oh, I've cut some of the stuff up in the minicab. Do you want to see? So I was like, yeah. So I met him in a pub. He sat me down. He had his laptop, and he played me this footage of me in this cab office and like some music. And I was like, this is amazing.
I'm a genius.
I was like, you've captured it. You've captured my brilliance. And it's brilliantly shot and it looks real and it feels wicked. Just like awesome. So then, you know, I was smitten.
Yeah.
We did this short film and then we did some other character stuff. But he hadn't yet heard these prank calls that I'd done. I know it was one night around his with a few mates. I put on my CD, my prank call CD, and we listened to it.
Who wants to hear my prank call CD? Yeah. Right, this party's shit. Let's get it cooking. Have you got a CD player? Excellent.
Everyone.
Listen to this.
Hello, you have doved?
What do you think, guys?
Anyway, he was like completely, was like, this is brilliant, right? So he took it upon himself. He took one of the calls and he started putting pictures.
Oh.
To the call.
Yep.
Send it to me. I was like, this is brilliant. I love this, man. I did one where I called up. The first full one that we did, I called up a random dude and I was like, my first line was, I need a getaway driver. 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Kilburn High Road. Yes or no? He's like, what? You need a getaway driver? I was like, yeah, I need a getaway driver. I heard you were the man to call. Well, the thing is, like, I don't know how I kept this guy engaged, right? But he was telling me that, the thing is, I can't drive at the moment because I got my injury. I was like, upper or lower body? He's like, ah. I was like, perfect. It's a decoy. So I was like, I wouldn't let him go. And he started animating it, did the mouth and stuff. And then I was like, this is brilliant. So then we kind of sat down and we did it together. And I was like, oh, look, this is awesome. Like, we're properly working together on these visuals to make this call. Didn't know what we're going to do with it. Anyway, it's a Friday night or a Thursday night. 2005, really hot. I'm watching Channel 4 and it's Comedy Lab, Modern Toss.
Oh, yeah.
Was on. And then at the end of it, they were like, do you think you can do better than this? Well, send your stuff in to Comedy Lab, Channel 4. I was like, oh my God, yes. So I can write down the address. Called up Ed. I was like, Ed, man, can you put together everything, like edit all together, like a 10-minute thing? And I've got some scripts and stuff and my prank call CDs.
Yep.
And I hand-delivered it on the deadline at Horse Ferry Road, Channel 4. Month later, Ed calls me up. Dude, we've got a fucking meeting at Channel 4. They've seen the stuff. They want to meet us. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So then we got a pilot. And we were like, oh my God. We've got a fucking pilot.
Did you have to jump through a lot of hoops legally? Were there problems with...
You get consent.
Right, okay.
So I only call if I call someone, then you would have to get consent.
Would you phone them back or would you say at the end of the call?
Yeah, I wouldn't, but someone else would, a researcher.
Right. And most that. And did most people give consent?
A lot of them did. A few kind of, they were like, no. And those would hurt, you know.
Because you were, from the beginning, not in the business of humiliating them. I mean, I never enjoyed prank calls that were trying to kind of screw with people's minds too badly.
Yeah.
I felt with your stuff that you... I mean, it's always going to be a little bit on the edge. Were you conscious of pushing things and making them edgy? Were you sort of thinking, well, this feels a little bit edgy. I'm just going to push it a little bit.
I never wanted to be edgy.
Right.
For me, it's about feeling naughty, yes. But I never wanted to kind of... I never wanted to, like, ruin someone's day. Mm-hmm. I wasn't looking for an aggressive reaction. I was looking for an interaction that would develop a lot of the time.
What was your favorite or one of your favorites that maybe is a little bit offbeat that isn't a regularly...
I remember the one of the first times I played Terry Tibbs, who's like my, who just came from like, oh, you know, what kind of guy buys an Aston Martin? Because a lot of the time, like, a lot of the sources of my numbers as well were car adverts, phone book, ads in general. I mean, how well was the internet working then? It was working pretty well, but I would just have phone book, Thompson Directory.
Thompson Local.
And the calls would either be... inspired by the ad or loot, you know, yeah. Things for sale, wooden ladders, talk to me, you know, that's like one of the most kind of Terry Tibbs quoted back to me calls that I do, you know, and it was like my 58th call of the morning, you know what I mean? It's like wooden ladders, talk to me. And she was like, who's this? Oh, she was a northern lass. She was like, oh no, I'm not having you talk to me like that, you know. And it was like it got her blood going, right?
Yeah.
And that's what you want, that kind of interaction where they're giving as good as they get. And I love that. And what would happen, actually, we had in the office, I'd be in like my booth and all the animators would be there with Ed. And they'd be like, if a call was good, I'd upload it. And then they'd all be listening to like the calls that I made that day. And when I'd come out of that booth, if I could see them kind of giggling at their computers, I felt so good. It was hard, man. I think it took like 8 or 9 months. To make the first season. It was intense, man.
Because
I'd do the calls and then I'd come out and I'd be animating with Ed and all of them lot.
What was the impulse to turn it into a more visual thing? I suppose it's obvious that you're an actor, you like to dress up, you wanted to be on camera.
I'd spent 2 years doing prank phone calls and animation. And I wanted to do some characters in real life. And, you know... We didn't know what we were going to do, but Channel 4 were like, right, we believe in you guys. Here's some money. Play. Just do some shit and see what happens.
Good old days.
Good old days, right? So we had a little office in Hattrick Productions. Myself, Ed, and our researcher, Joe Varley.
This is 2010.
This is not. Yeah, this is 2010. This, time. This is 2010. Or was it 2009? And we just start playing and like, I'm just there doing voices, doing impressions, doing characters, jumping up and like doing something. And then we kind of go, oh, what should we do? What should we do? Should we? And then the first character I ever did actually out and about was like an old Indian man.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any prosthetics. I just had like a really bad gray moustache. And I had a mobility scooter and it was called Din Huni. And it was just, I don't know why it was called that. It was like a play on Houdini or Din Huni. And yeah. So we went with some hidden cameras to IKEA. And I had learned the lesson very quickly that it's all very well pretending to be someone else. But for an audience to find that interesting, you got to be doing something. You can't just be... driving around going, oh, hey, look at me. I'm pretending to be... Everyone thinks I'm an old Indian man because I'm, you know, going on my scooter in IKEA. Literally 5 minutes in, to be in IKEA, we had security guard. They just clocked us immediately. So we were like, okay, this is quite tricky then. Hidden camera stuff with a real person having real interactions with people. This is going to be weird. Because there was no like, hey, you've done those things on the telephone. Just put some prosthetics on. You can play them in real life. It'd be great. It was like, no, actually, what am I doing in these scenarios?
Yeah, it's a totally different genre with a different set of challenges.
Completely. And it was, again, it was like...
And you're in the heavy prosthetics
not yet,
and makeup.
Not yet. Oh, okay. So I'm like, well, look, I need to do something like Eddie Murphy did in Coming to America, mm-hmm. in the barbershop scene where he's playing like six different people. I can do that. So then Joe finds a prosthetic makeup artist called Christian Mallet, and I have a meeting with him, and he's very serious, and you know, he's not, I keep cracking jokes and he just completely ignores me. And you know, he's a very serious and talented individual who's like, look, if you want to look like Terry Tibbs, I can make you look like Terry Tibbs. And I was like, no fucking way you're going to make me look like Terry. There's no way. And the first morning of when we were going to shoot that, we hired a Rolls Royce. And I go to Christian Mallet's workshop. I walk in and I just see Terry's face on a fucking plaster cast of my face. And I'm like, there's no way that you're going to stick that on my face and I'm going to be, anyone's going to fucking believe that I'm actually a 60-year-old white man from Rickmansworth. No fucking way. Anyway, 4 hours later, it's just unbelievable. The excitement and the rush, it was just amazing. I was Terry Tibbs and I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is amazing. I felt like a superhero. Yeah. I felt like I could fly. And again, it was like, actually, even though that day was amazing and I love being Terry, the point of him existing didn't yet make sense within a new show, whatever uh-huh. that show would be. And even after, you know, our 3 month development period, I had all these characters. But again, the purpose of them wasn't nailed down. And I was like, this could fail, man. And I remember it was January. I was like, I've got to do the pilot of this. I've got to get this right. Figure out what the next thing is after Phone Jacket. Then I've got to go off and do Four Lions.
Right, you'd been cast in that.
Yeah, been cast in that. So I was like, fuck, this is like serious. I remember it was New Year's Eve. I had a fucking brandy and marijuana induced meltdown in a pub. And I was like, right, I'm going to stop drinking. So I stopped drinking. I wasn't an alcoholic or anything, but I was just got to the point where I was like, this is bad. My relationship had gone bad. And I was like, right. I didn't drink for 6 months. And this 6 month period, I did the taster for whatever Face Jacker was going to be. Those long days in prosthetic. You're paranoid. You think, oh my God, they know I'm wearing a prosthetic. I'm not fooling anyone. You know, your nerves are shredded. Like, I think with actors as well, the reason that actors sometimes have meltdowns and go off is because their emotional taps have to be open. And sometimes it's not easy to close those taps.
Yeah.
You know, because you're using that part of yourself that is, it's fucking, you know, it's,
well, it's also
slightly unhinged.
It's unhinged. It's also kind of unnatural in a way. It's not what most people do. In normal social interaction, most people tend to be straight with each other, honest with each other. They don't put on an accent. They don't try and fool each other.
They do.
Obviously, it does happen, and there are layers of it.
I think that happens more than actually an honest interaction takes place.
Yeah, maybe.
They do put voices on. They do try and pull the wool over your eyes. They are trying to make you think something of them. I think it happens all the time. And when I become these characters, it's like I'm free of that because I can just go fucking all out with it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So any insecurities in my own life, I really want you to think I'm this or that, or, you know, handsome, attractive, charismatic, funny. All those things go out the window. And also that's something to be said about acceptance, which is what I think a big part of playing another character in this way, where it does feel like a holiday from yourself mm-hmm. and your own insecurities and how you see yourself in the world and how you imagine other people perceive you.
but you know, I'm talking like this, but I'm really having a conversation, you know.
It's that actually I've made myself into this shape because I'm luring you in.
Mm.
And then you might think a certain thing about, because you hear that voice, so you imagine I'm a certain way.
Why is he doing the racist voice?
Why is he doing the racist voice? But, you know, I've called you up. You don't know that I'm doing a voice. You think that's a real person. And actually, that's speaking to the racist or the prejudice in you, because that's the whole point.
Yeah.
I think that doing this character is going to induce some kind of reaction from you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to use that against you, or you're going to prove me wrong. And actually, we're going to have a great conversation and a great interaction. And that was part of the journey that I was going on.
Mm.
Before
we come back to you being a massive racist and doing the accents, which, you know, we have to talk about, I think. Obviously, I don't think you're a massive racist, but there are elements of that show that I'm interested in the conversations you are having about them. Maybe we'll talk about it now.
Yeah.
Because also you're involved with Four Lions at that point. That is also a production that had a lot of controversy around it before people had seen it. And they were, this is Chris Morris's film about these wannabe jihadis from Sheffield.
Yeah.
Not even a decade after the Twin Towers attack, when the war on terror is still very much raging. Islamophobia is raging as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of project that could easily be and was easily misinterpreted. I don't think it was controversial when it came out. I mean, when people saw Four Lions, they understood what the deal was.
I got a sense that people wanted to be outraged by it before they watched it.
Yeah.
But actually what happened was it came out in like 96 cinemas, and then by the weekend it increased to like 300 cinemas.
Yes.
Because it was like a huge hit.
And Chris Morris was never interested in just pushing people's buttons for the sake of it. He spent and always does spend a great deal of time researching and spending time with the kind of people that he's
very much so
writing about.
He's forensic and he's always looking for the truth in everything. And he's not a sensationalist, and there's no slop in anything that he does. There's no laziness in anything that he does, and that's what makes him just an amazing director and someone you will just do anything for.
And would he break down what he was trying to do as far as the portrayal of British Muslims, things like that? Did you ever have conversations about
that? He wasn't
trying
to portray British Muslims. He was portraying five guys who were Muslim, who had decided that they were going to do something about what was going on in the world in their own misguided way.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, fair enough. I sort of fell into the tabloid trap of assuming that this is a kind of...
We'll get you out of that, don't worry.
But you know what I mean? It was the film was easily portrayed as that. It's like, this is what Chris Morris thinks of Muslims in Britain kind of thing. There would be a conversation now about a person of one nationality playing a person of another nationality or a different...
I'll just spit it out.
No, but you know what I mean? Like, those conversations were not happening to the same degree that they're happening now back in 2010.
No. It was never a conversation I ever have had, really.
Yeah.
Ever.
Little Britain had been out since it started in 2003, I think, Little Britain.
Yeah, on the radio, right?
On the radio, right. The TV show had been out for a few years. I can't remember if they had started doing their more outrageous prosthetics, blacking up, etc.
Yeah.
By that point. But did you have a conversation around that area with your producer and with your commissioning editor and about the wisdom of portraying black characters particularly and wearing the big black prosthetic?
I didn't have any conversations with anyone because for me, I was playing white, black, brown. I was playing everyone basically. So it was just another character in my repertoire.
Yeah.
You know? And going back to Eddie Murphy in that barbershop, you know, that for me was the inspiration of like, listen, man, I can do characters like Eddie Murphy can do characters, and I've got the prosthetics, and now, you know, as I said, to actually nail a good prank in prosthetics was like really difficult. So the fact that we actually did two seasons of Facejacker and it was as popular as it was, that's just down to, all we wanted was to make something that was very funny.
Mm.
And that was difficult.
Did you ever get any pushback at the time from people saying, actually, it's not as simple as just saying, oh, I'm an equal? Because sometimes what you get from comedians, certain comedians, is they say, well, yeah, I'm a equal opportunities offender. I'll go after anyone, blah, blah, blah. I don't care what color they are. But actually, it's not that simple, is it? Because it becomes whether you believe in the whole Marxist idea of everything being a power struggle or whatever. The fact is that not every minority group has a similar status within society. So the idea of kind of taking the piss out of one group is not necessarily the same as taking the piss out of another group. It has a different effect. It's operating within a different nexus of prejudice.
Okay, but what I'm saying is that you're saying that me playing a character is taking the piss out of that character.
That's the way it's easily portrayed or assimilated.
That's not a motivating factor in me wanting to play a character. Any character I want to play feels like I'm stepping into a superhero's skin.
Mm-hmm.
And that superhero allows me to interact with anyone and to do it in a funny way where I can outsmart them and manipulate them to the point where we've had an interaction that's worth editing down and presenting as entertainment on TV. You know, I love all my characters that I play, and I've only ever been motivated by love, you know, and actually wanting to be funny. But, you know, I didn't pick an easy medium to try and make jokes. But for me, it wasn't about making jokes as much. It was about wanting to play characters in real life situations, which I do very well.
Yeah. So it was, I mean, with you got from some other shows sometimes, if people portrayed certainly black characters and they weren't themselves black, you got the sense that there was a part of them that knew it was, they were on dodgy ground. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That they'd lived through the 90s and felt as if most of the conversations around race had been more or less had. Everyone was fine with each other. Yeah. Everyone knew that racism was bad. So now let's just play around and go a little bit nuts. But by the end of the first decade of the 2000s, I think that people were beginning to think about it a little differently.
I mean, I made a point around the time that I made Phone Jacker, and that was, if Phone Jacker had been made by four white guys, it might have been looked at very differently.
Right, yes, yes.
Rather than being performed by one brown guy, i.e. me.
Yeah.
And it is a very complicated and complex world to try and
navigate.
But I don't want to feel that I'm navigating, because I don't want to feel like, oh, I mustn't say the wrong thing, you know, in case it gets put into exclamation marks and, you know, used against me. It's like, actually, no, my comedy has come from me. It's honest in the way that I honestly wanted to play these characters. I honestly wanted to, from my background, being second generation Iranian in London, these are the people that I have experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the characters, and these are the personalities that I've absorbed. And all I'm doing through either the deception of being over the telephone or in a disguise, I'm able to express whatever it was that I absorbed in a comedic way that people find funny. And I find funny. Now, in 2021 or 2022, whenever you put this out, 2023 maybe. Definitely. Things never stop changing. And they will continue to change
and
evolve. And absolutely, when I hear people go, oh, you can't make jokes about nothing anymore. You can. Of course you can. You can make jokes about everything now. You know, you don't want to be there going, oh, I can't say this, I can't say that. Well, maybe you can't. Say something else. You know, what, you want to say the same joke that you said 25 years ago? Well, you're welcome to.
Yeah, but you'll meet some resistance.
Well, but also, you know, the joke that you deliver, the joke that you present to someone is presented to them, right? Their experience that got them to this point where you're now going, here, have a joke, right? They need to feel that you may have swam through the same waters of experience, because you're going, I'm a comedian, I'm basing my joke on my experience, which I've now put into this joke, and mm-hmm. I'm presenting with this joke. If I'm trying to give you a joke that I gave you 15 years ago, then you're like, where have you been for the last 15 years?
You know,
everything, my experience I'm carrying, the atmosphere that we're, the air that we're breathing is clearly different. And this dies because this no longer survives in this atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. So I like that because you made it sound like space.
Well,
but I mean, you've done a new series on Spotify of phone jacker
I have.
Calls. And you're not doing all the characters that you would have done 11 years ago.
I'm doing a lot of the characters. I'm doing a lot of new characters. And, you know, depending on when you put this out currently, it's been very positive. And yeah. It's at number 2 in the charts.
Good one.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I'm blown away by it. Because actually, there was a time when I thought, oh, God, I'm doing characters and accents and people from different countries. And also, you know, quite a lot of posh white people, too. But is this going to be misconstrued, or, you know, is it going to be used against me somehow? Is there going to be some kind of backlash? And I mean, it's a weird thing to be anxious about, because really, as a comedian, all you really want to be anxious about is, are people going to find it funny?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but now
but there's a whole new machine that right. I feel can, you know, inhale this and spit it out in a way that creates a shape that people recognize as, oh no, that's bad.
Yeah.
Without actually going, you know, like, oh, Four Lines, you can't make jokes about terrorists, without actually having seen the movie.
Yes.
But, you know, my comedy is very personal to me and the mission and the journey that I'm on and have been on in my life.
Mm.
And ultimately, any interaction I have is about tolerance, is about acceptance. And I need to play characters from different countries or, you know, backgrounds if I want to, because that's the character that I've created for whatever reason. And there's never any bad intention behind it. It's never about making fun of that character. It's always a part of me.
Yeah.
These characters are all parts of me.
I guess the argument would be that I don't really care what your intention is. This is the net result of these kinds of attitudes or these kinds of jokes. Like in the olden days, you would have heard, I think most people were on the same page about, like, well, where's this coming from? You know, okay, so you're going to do an accent of, you're a white person doing an accent of a person of color. Where's the joke? Who's the butt of the joke? Is this making fun of their culture? Is this sort of belittling them somehow? Or is it coming from a more generous place? That's the way you used to process those kinds of things. But I think now it's just like, no, don't even go there, because you haven't walked in that person's shoes. You don't know what their lives are like. Best just leave it alone. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the argument that I hear from some people. I
don't believe that you'd listen to any phone jacker calls and think that.
No, I mean, I didn't.
You know.
I still... Because
you experience the characters as well. You're basically experiencing a conversation between a real person and me in character. And what you get from that interaction is very different to if I had played that character in isolation in a scripted thing. Then, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go near that.
Mm.
I wouldn't do that, you know. But because it's an interaction with a real person, there's value there, intrinsic value, that is funny and enlightening and interesting, and it makes you laugh.
And these are all people who will have found out that it was this bloke of Iranian heritage doing the voices. Do you still speak the language?
I speak Farsi. But I'm mainly...
Farsi. You have Farsi. To sort of do it like...
Farsi. Salam. if I'm ordering an Iranian takeaway, then I'll be the fucking whiz kid Farsi. Alo? Salam hala shoma. Merci, خیلی ممنون. میشه takeaway سفارش بدم؟ And as takeaway, yeah. I don't know. میشه takeaway سفارش بدم؟ بله یه دونه پرس کوبیده.
Scooby Doo, I love it.
No, کوبیده. یه دونه پرس کوبیده. یه دونه مخصوص. یه دونه جوجه کباب بی استخون. This for the Iranian listeners, if you have any. I'd be surprised if you do. Have you heard that Adam Boxon is fantastic? Fantastic. I don't know.
You'd be surprised. It's very diverse anyway, listenership.
I mean, you know, to be honest, this is the first conversation I've had about this. And it's... I don't feel that I'm enlightening anyone. I don't feel that I'm doing anything other than either painting myself as a victim.
Yes.
Or painting myself as someone that doesn't care.
Yeah.
And
no, that's the problem with these conversations is that, especially on social media, you're expected to occupy one of two positions.
I know, but I want to have an intelligent conversation about it, but also I feel like the energy that goes into trying to have a nuanced, enlightening conversation is just ends up feeling like, please don't hate me. I just really love doing these characters. And, you know, if I don't do these characters, then what am I going to do? Everything I've ever done that was good was based around this kind of thing. And, you know, I enjoy it. And so do a lot of other people. Please don't hate me. That feels like the most honest reaction. I'm going to prove you all wrong. I'm going to get on that telephone and I'm going to pretend to be a Turkish man that I met in Kilmanai Road just 2 weeks ago who thinks that a DVD is pronounced doved. And you're going to love it. And I was right.
They did, you know. You called someone up.
Yeah, what's up, mate?
Yes, how much for your doved player?
What?
Doved player.
DVD, mate.
Doved.
DVD. And what I'm doing is I'm going, can you tolerate the fact that English is not my first language, that this is an innocent mistake, but I'm sticking with it and I'm happy with it. And does it really bother you that much that I don't say DVD? And if it does bother you so much, then what does that say about you?
You're talking as the character now.
This is what's going on in my own mind.
Right.
In this interaction where I've managed to get someone that runs a hi-fi shop to get angry at me because I don't say DVD, I say doved. Because what I'm doing is going, now this is how I'm going to say it. And yes, I'm foreign, but is that enough? Are you going to let me do it and just get on with your life? Or are you going to hold on to that little thing?
Mm-hmm.
And what does that say about you? And that's what I find so revealing about this medium that I found myself in, where, yeah, it's a prank, but at the same time, it's a test. Every time I speak to someone as someone that is foreign, that foreign character that I'm doing is my foreignness. And it's the foreignness that I feel, even though English is my first language, I was born here. The foreigner that I feel, that skin that I can't shed, I'm going, you know what? I'm just going to go full pasty with it and throw something at you and try and expose part of you because I sense it in you even if I'm talking to you as me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's going on between us? What happens between two human beings when they interact with each other? Where's my prejudice? Where's your prejudice? You know, what are your pre-existing notions of me just by looking at me? And then when I open my mouth, how does that shift your perception of me?
Mm-hmm. I'm not racist. I'm not prejudiced.
Oh, yeah, you know, this is a very tolerant country, very tolerant country. That racism doesn't exist anymore. You know, that's I'm hearing people say that to my face. And I'm going, well, that's not true, is it? Because I know that I'm no angel. And I know that you're definitely no fucking angel. Why can't we have a more honest conversation rather than just slap a fucking band-aid on it and go, you know, look, I love this country. I love the UK. It's stunningly gorgeous. I grew up here and I love London and the mix of people that I've got to experience in my life here. You know, I haven't fucked off to Norfolk yet, but I'd like to. My granddad's buried in Norfolk, by the way.
I buried him.
Yeah, I buried him up there. So,
yeah,
is that my closing gambit?
That was good, man.
But what is it? It's like, you know,
I was spending time with Kevin Novak.
He's having a total meltdown.
He couldn't.
When you were doing your speech just then, that was an incredible portrait of
a lady,
a man having a total breakdown. All the voices and the thinking and the double thinking and the anticipating.
I'm an artist.
I know.
I'm an artist. I couldn't express myself.
It was a very compelling portrait of the modern sensibility in crisis.
I was spending time with Adam Buxton. He'd invited me onto his podcast. I got a sense that he was a little tense, and I realised it was because he hadn't ejaculated in over 6 days.
Have you not ejaculated in 6 days? That must be strange for you.
Are you okay?
You know, I don't like it when people do impressions of my impression back to me when I'm trying to do an impression.
It's very close to Broomfield, though, isn't it?
Is it?
I mean, it is. They sound similar. They have similar vocal mannerisms. And it's the slightly strained thing.
I think I'm a little offended by that statement.
You're very good at doing the whispery thing that Louis does.
My time with Adam was done. After 4 hours of talking shit on his podcast, my time with Adam was at an end. You're listening to the Louis Theroux podcast. I turned my microphone upside down in order to create a pre-credit sequence fuck-up that always put my audience at ease.
Are you able to break down how you do your impressions? Are you able to...
I have zones, I guess. But, I mean, I don't do a lot of impressions.
No, anymore. Okay.
I hardly do any. Who do I do? Louis, I've enjoyed doing a lot for friends and family. I'll make my father-in-law, for example, the star of one of his documentaries, right. You know.
I was spending time with Paul the Builder. He just bought a house in his daughter's name to save 30% on stamp duty.
Shit like that. He fucking loves that.
Adam Curtis, then.
I don't know if my Adam Curtis is that good, because he's just... What was happening next would change the course of history forever. That kind of thing, isn't
it? Yeah, but there's a... Let's remind ourselves of his voice.
I really enjoy doing. Don't enjoy doing a lot anymore.
Well, I saw you on Lorraine doing quite a good Connery.
Yeah. Well, she made that because she was enjoying it so much, you know. Oh, man, have you seen, just to segue, but him on Aspel with a young Boris Johnson?
No.
Oh, man.
Oh, yes.
And Ricky Thomas was like, every time he cracks a joke. Or every time Sean Connery makes fun of Boris. It's very...
Boris used to be a sort of amusing panel guest, I suppose.
He's like
he
a whipping boy, but now he's Prime Minister.
Adam Curtis. It's more... It's
That's quite good. Let's see. If you like doing shit impressions.
Being a confident self to over the last 10 years to being very unconfident.
Unconfident. It's quite high.
You're unconfident.
Whenever Buckles was preparing food in the kitchen, he noticed that all the kitchen knives were blunt. This made chopping veg, especially squashy tomatoes, a frustrating and dispiriting process. He invested in a set of expensive ceramic knives, and for a while they worked well, slicing through even the squashiest veg.
That's gone.
Cleanly and precisely.
Why the veg thing? Why the kitchen?
Because I'm incorporating a story from my own life.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, who's Buckles?
Me.
You're Buckles?
I'm A.A. Buckles, Dr. Buckles.
Oh, fuck. Oh, is this like a...
When we were on the radio, me and Joe, people used to give us silly names.
And Buckles was one of them?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. So this is actually playing to your core.
Yeah.
Fuck, sorry, guys. Oh, God.
But Buckles' instruction...
Are you angry at me for some reason? Yeah, but I thought...
But Buckles' instructions...
You can't red card my Louis Theroux.
About taking care of the ceramic knives. See, I'll put some Brian Eno under this and that'll lift it.
All right.
Which included not dropping them or putting them in the dishwasher, were ignored by the rest of the house.
Can you not record this when I'm gone?
Who claimed he was being uptight.
But you need to always come to the abrupt end that he does.
He shot himself.
He always does. Man, everyone shoots themselves. It's brilliant, especially in his latest one. It's nuts. You're like, oh, wow, this story's great. And then he shot himself. Oh, God. He did? But I thought he was going to change the world.
Alan Greenspan believed in a philosophy called logical positivism.
Oh, that's good, yeah. Yeah, the positivism. Well, his isms are good. That's good. I like that.
But at this very moment, a new president of the United States was elected who believed the opposite. He was convinced that he could use political power in its traditional way to transform the world for the better.
I was spending time doing impressions of Adam Curtis in Adam Buxton's podcast.
Could I have a go at that? Adam Greenspan believed... I'm just not getting... I feel silly. Are you angry at me for some reason?
Wait.
This is an advert for Squarespace. Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right. Stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No. It's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul, and I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts and I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
Continue.
Table for one, yes.
And are you looking for lunch or dinner?
I don't know. It's my birthday, you see.
So you're looking for lunch or dinner?
Well, I don't know. It's my birthday, you see. What do you think? What would you recommend?
I don't know. Would you like to come at lunch or at dinner?
Well, I don't know. It's my birthday, you see. So what do you recommend?
Welcome back, podcats. That was Kay Van Novak talking to me there. And you also heard a short clip from his recent Phone Jacker series on Spotify. Link in the description. Very nice to see Kay Van and to be pleasurably assaulted by the many people that live inside him, including Louis Theroux, of course. Don't think Louis's heard that impression of him. Maybe I'll... see what he thinks next time he comes on the podcast. Oh man, my hands are cold. Rosie, come on, Black Fox. Let's head back. Thanks again to everybody who came out to my book shows over the last few months. I'm so grateful to you all for hanging in there with all the rescheduling. I had a great time and it made me want to do more live bits and pieces, which I hope I'll do next year. Try some slightly different stuff out, as well as do some more bug shows. That's the plan. Hope we're going to do a couple more new shows. I'm doing the Bowie special as well again. Haven't done that in a few years. But I'm doing two shows on the 6th and 7th at the BFI South Bank, but it's part of a Bowie screen season that they're having there to coincide with his 75th birthday. I'll put a link in the description to a piece that describes what you can expect from that BFI season. Hello, dog.
I love you. Oh, did you know?
Yes. Flappy reset. Also, I was recently on a Beatles podcast, Your Own Personal Beatles, it's called. Hosted by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. Very enjoyable podcast. They've had lots of good guests on there. John Ronson's been on there. Matthew Crosby. Even got a shout out on that Matthew Crosby episode. Nish Kumar, Felicity Ward, Laura Barton, music journalist. was on there. Very good episode, that one. And I went on there recently to waffle about my Beatles-related memories from over the years. Gave me another excuse to play my version of How Do You Sleep. And also I dug out a bit of audio of Doors keyboard player Ray Manzarek talking about Rubber Soul from when we did Vinyl Justice with him, me and Joe, years ago at his house in Los Angeles. But it was good fun talking to Jack and Robin. There's a link to their Apple Podcast page in the description. But that's it for this week. Thanks very much indeed to Seamus Murphy Mitchell for all his work on this episode and his general production support. Thanks to Helen Green, who does the artwork for this podcast. Thanks to everybody at Acast for helping me keep the show on the road. Thanks, as ever, most of all, to you for listening. Till next time, stay fresh with the beat. Keep your room nice and neat. Be kind to your feet. That's the word on the street. It's raining. Do you want a hug? Come on. I love you. Bye!